China exploited the Soviet Union's unsuspecting support, gleaning Russian manufacturing and military secrets, while simultaneously weakening its supposed ally and benefactor by receiving monetary and military aid. The USSR was also fighting American active measures on many Cold War fronts at this time, but China's actions helped drain the Eastern Bloc. The first move. In 1970, 1 year after China ominously detonated 2 hydrogen bombs near its Russian border, Mao sent a message to President Richard Nixon inviting him to visit China. In Washington, this was seen as an intriguing opening. Nixon and his Cold Warrior Secretary of State Henry Kissinger saw the opportunity to work with China as a way to further destabilize and isolate the USSR. Washington policy leaders were completely unaware that China's gambit was a long game. Mao and the CCP, having extracted all they could from the Soviets, who were clearly losing ground to Western technological and economic developments, needed to latch on to a new host. They found one. The one with the deepest pockets, the best research and design infrastructure, the most innovative technology, and the strongest armed forces in the world. The United States of America. In his book, The 100-Year Marathon, China watcher Michael Pillsbury reveals that even as Mao offered his olive branch to Nixon, he regarded the United States as the enemy, and that Chinese documents likened it to Hitler. Pillsbury also recounts how China's foreign minister, Zhou Enlai, during a meeting with Kissinger, proclaimed that America is the Ba. The Chinese interpreter politely rendered this statement as America is the leader. But this was a blatant mistranslation. Ba, as used in most political language, means tyrant. When the translator was later asked why he softened Zhou's message to Kissinger, he said, it would have upset him. It also might have alarmed and enlightened him. Instead, the United States, unaware of the CCP's hostile attitudes toward it, embraced a policy of helping China in order to destabilize the Soviet Union. Duplicating its strategy with the USSR, China played the role of the insignificant country. Actually, it didn't have to work very hard at the role, since it was regarded as what the West now calls a developing nation. Extremely poor, with little to no manufacturing technology, limited higher education, and few resources beyond its massive low-wage workforce. China still claims this status today. It is easy to see how Nixon, Kissinger, and so many other U.S. leaders were lulled into a false sense of security, despite the CCP's staggering record of human rights abuses and its totalitarian single-party system. In the 1970s, China's leaders indicated to American diplomats that the country had no problem isolating Russia and ceding more power to the United States on the global stage. The idea of selling American goods to 1 billion Chinese people somewhere down the line must have been enticing as well. The danger of capitalist magical thinking. It is also critical to see how U.S. leaders assumed that building a relationship with China would result in political changes in Beijing. The United States had, and still has, a vision of itself as a nation builder. We helped reshape Europe after World War II and did a pretty good job of it. We helped democratize Taiwan. We also helped Japan, South Korea, and, after the end of the Cold War, former members of the Soviet bloc, like Poland and the Czech Republic, grow into democracies. For some reason, many policymakers and investors seem to assume that capitalism has special powers that can melt away authoritarianism and totalitarianism. History and recent current events, however, tell us this is nothing more than magical thinking. We have spent billions and billions of dollars trying and failing to turn Iraq and Afghanistan into self-sustaining democracies. Egypt, Uganda, and other authoritarian-leaning nations have received billions of dollars in U.S. military and financial aid, and they still can't get over the hump to achieve lasting democracy. Ditto for many of our allies in the Middle East, Africa, and Latin America. When Deng Xiaoping rose to power in 1978, the CCP recalibrated its attitude toward trade and capitalism. The country was open to receiving foreign investment and participated in the growing global market, but only on its terms. Foreign money could come into China, but had to remain there. Profits could not be transferred overseas without a great deal of difficulty. China also allowed its citizens to participate in certain Western practices. They could start businesses, create wealth, and wear baseball caps instead of Mao caps. But Beijing kept strict controls over everything else, cementing in no uncertain terms a totalitarian state. There is only one political party with power in China, the CCP. It controls all facets of life in China. It says there shall be no free speech, no freedom of religion, no freedom of the press. The People's Liberation Army is not, in fact, China's army. It is a wing of the CCP. Every business in China must, by law, have a member of the CCP on its board. In May 1989, there was a brief glimmer of hope that a significant segment of the Chinese population wanted democratic reforms. For 3 weeks, as many as 1 million people, students, workers, civil rights leaders, gathered to stage pro-democracy rallies in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. On June 4th, the military was called to silence the protesters. A massacre ensued. Reports of the number of protesters slaughtered have varied, ranging from a few hundred, according to the CCP, to as many as 10,000, per a British diplomatic cable. An estimated 10,000 were arrested. On June 5th, one of the most dramatic moments of the late 20th century occurred. A man holding two shopping bags stood in front of an approaching Chinese tank, blocking its path in a life-or-death game of chicken. The identity of the tank man remains a mystery. While millions watched this dramatic showdown all over the globe, to most Chinese citizens, the heroic incident itself remains unknown. Images and references to it not only are banned in China, but are actively hunted down by sophisticated algorithm-powered censors and thousands of social media monitors. 1 month after the Tiananmen crackdown, a telling photo surfaced that was equally disturbing in its way. The sight of U.S. National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and Deng Xiaoping beaming at each other, arms outstretched. Scowcroft was there for a secret meeting at the direction of President George H.W. Bush. That picture and others that surfaced told China and the world everything they needed to know. Bush was backing down. America was willing to concede to China's totalitarian rule. At that point, American foreign policy became about opening markets, and the justification was the belief that free trade would eventually free China. Somehow, a theory of the earnings of freedom took hold, an idea that democracy would rule the sleeping giant when per capita income passed $6,000. James Mann, in his book The China Fantasy, calls the West's idea that China will morph into a liberal democratic society the soothing scenario. He summarizes the logic this way. The country's rapid economic growth will lead to far-reaching political change as well. Eventually, increasing trade and prosperity will bring liberalization and democracy to China. Mann also talks about the opposite of the soothing scenario, the upheaval scenario, in which doubters envision China collapsing as a result of economic chaos or some kind of mass revolution. The result is turmoil and chaos. Mann was way ahead of the curve when he wrote his book back in 2007, a time when China was literally exploding with commerce and manufacturing. 6 years earlier, in 2001, Bill Clinton signed a law passed by Congress establishing permanent, normal trade relations with China. With that relationship codified, U.S. investor confidence skyrocketed, and so did business. China's economy soared as well due to a confluence of events. China was then accepted as a member of the World Trade Organization. Apple unveiled the iPod, and an eruption of digital goods turned into an avalanche of international investment. Despite China's exponential growth, man didn't believe in either the soothing or the upheaval scenario. For him, all signs indicated that the CCP would continue to hone its brand of authoritarian capitalism. End of story. And he has been proven absolutely right. The power of capital and free trade has made China rich. It has lifted hundreds of millions up from poverty. It has also made many investors and business owners outside China untold billions of dollars. But it hasn't made China democratic or increased civil liberties. There is no free press. There is no freedom of speech or religion. These foundational concepts of the United States and the West are regarded as an existential threat to the CCP, so much so that in 2013, the party put it in writing. In a position paper known as Document 9, the CCP states that the promotion of universal values, the belief that Western freedom, democracy, and human rights are universal and eternal, is an attack on the foundations of the CCP. It goes on to warn against promoting Western constitutional democracy, which it describes as an attempt to undermine the current leadership and the socialism with Chinese characteristics system of governance. Mirror, mirror. Remember that rope-a-dope move China pulled on the Soviet Union? They've been using it on America. While pretending to be battered and struggling, the CCP has weakened America's core strengths. Our economy, our technology, our military, our influence on the world stage. But we have allowed this to happen. Our political and economic leaders and our greed helped facilitate this rope-a-dope. We thought we would boost our own wealth, profits, and standard of living, and in a way we have. Stock prices have soared, real estate markets have boomed, collapsed, and boomed again. But in many ways, we are poorer as a nation. Our infrastructure is a disaster, and many of our cities are plagued by unemployment and drug abuse, victims of the decision to export work to China. Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's straight-shooting, controversial ex-chief strategist and former Goldman Sachs VP and U.S. Navy officer, describes the trade-off this way. Let's be brutally frank. Slaves in China made products financed by London and New York for the unemployed in the West. That's exactly what we've had. Slaves in China making products for a neo-feudalist system where the working class and the lower class own nothing and buy cheap shit. They can continue along the hamster wheel because the shit's so cheap because it's provided by slaves. And yes, equity values go up. Margins are higher. But it's not a way humans should live. Bannon is absolutely right. He may be a polarizing figure, but it's worth noting that while hosting a May 15, 2019 CNBC interview with Bannon about Donald Trump's tariff battle with China, liberal globalism champion Thomas Friedman said, "I really agree with so much of what Steve said about confronting China's unfair trading practices." A year earlier, Friedman had written in the New York Times that the president's instinct is basically right, to hold the line before China gets too big. Abandoning manufacturing has been devastating for America. Since the 1970s, U.S. manufacturing plants have shut their doors, lured by the low labor costs of manufacturing in Asia. But for the past 20 years, American businesses have turned China into a manufacturing monolith. We now depend on it for an incalculable number of items, many of which are critical to maintaining our standard of living, such as medical supplies, scientific gear, electronics, and motherboards, as well as the sensors that control our cars, heating systems, and security systems. So our thirst for profits and our inability to embrace long-term strategies that strengthen our nation have hurt us and helped China. Furthermore, our nation has been gripped by outdated thinking. Most countries, including America, fear that a society will be dramatically changed as a result of a military invasion. But the invasion we are facing is much more insidious. We are slowly having our freedoms eroded by our economic connections to a totalitarian state that openly opposes our core values. Each time a Chinese company invests in a U.S. firm, each time a major American company's data is hacked by the PLA, each time it pays for a congressman or a scientist to attend a junket, each time it opens a Confucius Center on a university campus, the CCP is accruing more influence in the United States. Our blind generosity has been taken advantage of for nearly 50 years. Since the 1970s, Chinese graduate students have filled out the student body at one U.S. institution of higher learning after another. Many of these students, directed by the CCP and Chinese companies, learned and copied the knowledge of America's world-beating STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math programs. The funds generated by these students have been used to intimidate and silence scholars within universities who are critical of China. Since the end of the Cold War, China has failed to commit militarily to war-ravaged places like Syria and Afghanistan, but has profited economically while the United States funds the cost of ensuring peace. All those engagements consume U.S. resources. Meanwhile, as laid out in its Belt and Road Initiative, something we'll explore in more depth later, China builds railroads and ports to control the world's shipping supply lines. The CCP would never agree to an open-ended commitment to rebuild and keep the peace in Afghanistan, where, as of 2018, the Pentagon said it was spending $45 billion per year with no end in sight. In fact, it is likely the CCP wouldn't even agree to 1 year of similar expenses. It is time to delve deeper into China's stealth war, the strategic decisions of Beijing, and our own habit of shooting ourselves in the foot. I aim to lay out the CCP's sophisticated gamesmanship and cold-blooded calculations, as well as the many strategies America and the West can deploy to counter and prevent undue Chinese influence. It will take a sea change to stop the CCP's march, starting with checking our own greed as investors and our own thirst for cheap goods as consumers. We, as Americans, have a choice. We can sit back and let China weaponize its wealth and influence against us, threatening the great freedoms that are the foundation of our nation. Or we can decide that the business of America cannot be business as usual. Our leaders, our entire nation, must recognize the threat we face and combat Chinese influence at every juncture. This is not some alarmist or racist call to action. Let me be clear. I love and admire the Chinese people, their language, and their culture. And when I refer to China, I am almost always referring to the nation controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. It is a thoughtful rebuttal to the influence the Chinese Communist Party has wielded for far too long. Our fate as the land of the free hangs in the balance. Chapter 3. Economy. The strategy of unrestricted warfare requires that the battlefield expand. So the CCP devises and enacts strategies to create influence and power on a global level. But it all starts with a totalitarian force building and wielding economic power. Because economic security underpins China's national security, it is the glue that holds China's house of cards together. And that glue, used in tandem with what the authors of Unrestricted Warfare call the bonding agent of data, has become so strong that what was once a flimsy construction now threatens to become impenetrable. Every country has a right to compete economically. The problem, however, is that the CCP doesn't believe in straightforward competition. The truth is that China is cheating, and Western U.S. political and corporate leaders, fueled by greed, propaganda, and fear, haven't called it out. That hurts American business and citizens. In 1991, China had a 2.3% share of the world's manufacturing exports. In 2013, it had an 18.8% share. The impact of this explosive growth for China has been fairly well documented. The shifts away from agriculture, the migration to cities, the shuttering of state-run enterprises in favor of government-backed free enterprise. But what does this dominance mean for the rest of the world? And specifically, for the United States? For the small percentage of Americans who invest in the stock market, earnings have skyrocketed. For areas of the country where manufacturing was part of the bedrock of the local economy, the loss of this industry has been devastating. Interestingly, among neoclassical economists, the accepted wisdom has been that free trade between two countries improves wealth for both parties. In their 2016 National Bureau of Economic Research, NBER, working paper on the impact of China's manufacturing revolution, the China Shock, economists David H. Otter, David Dorn, and Gordon H. Hansen say, "Theory assures us that under standard conditions, the gains to winners are more than sufficient to offset any losses incurred by those suffering adverse effects from foreign competition." The assumption behind this theory was that displaced workers would be retrained, new industries would arise, wages would not fall, and an equilibrium would be restored at a higher level. In a 2019 interview, Otter expounded on his paper's findings. Economists have long understood two things. One, that free trade among consenting nations increases GDP, gross domestic product, in those countries, allowing them to focus on activities in which they have a comparative advantage. And two, that it's not all improving, meaning it doesn't make every single person in those countries better off. Even if it expands the pie, it will almost necessarily shrink some slices and grow others. Some people will actually be worse off than they would have been in the absence of trade, even though the country that they live in is wealthier. The second point is where our work was very impactful, showing just how important that second point is. There was a kind of a background assumption that labor markets are fluid, so of course, import competing and manufacturing activities will contract, but people will reallocate quickly into other work. Over the past 20 years, anyone who has visited the Rust Belt or certain southern districts, which were once the center of American manufacturing, could tell you this assumption is deeply flawed. American manufacturing had been slowing since the end of World War II. The standard of living and the divide between the rich and poor in the United States have exploded since China joined the WTO. In other words, empirical economists who looked at the data afterward found that economic theory was false. Free trade does not always advance prosperity or lead to a more perfect union. The China Shock offers statistical evidence. From 1990 to 2007, areas more exposed to increased import competition from China experienced substantially larger reductions in manufacturing employment. Once active members of the working age population were unemployed or dropped out of the labor force. Not surprisingly, U.S. imports from China grew by more than exports, often substantially by more, in nearly every industry, according to the report. The result? Shock from the dramatic shift in trade, gutted communities, poverty-ravaged cities. In these depleted manufacturing areas, employment-to-population rates fall at least one for one with the decline in manufacturing employment and generally by slightly more, reports the study. One other damning study that indirectly showcases the decline of wealth in the United States comes from a distinctly nonpartisan and non-academic source, the U.S. Census Bureau. Comparing income and property data between the 2000 and 2010 surveys, the Bureau's Distribution of Household Wealth report found the chasm between America's rich and poor populations expanding at a stunning rate in terms of household net worth, all the assets a household owns minus the debt it owes. The report found that the median households in the bottom 20% saw their net worth decrease by $5,124 over the period. Meanwhile, the net worth of the median households in the top 20% increased by $61,379. So the rich got considerably richer, and the poor got considerably poorer. A 2017 study by the China Shock Trio follows up on the carnage of trade concussions. Its title conveys the intrinsic damage such economic upheaval can cause to a specific sector of the population. When work disappears, manufacturing decline, and the falling marriage market value of young men. Here's how the authors summarize what happens in communities where the job market suddenly dries up. On average, trade shocks differentially reduce employment and earnings, raise the prevalence of idleness, and elevate premature mortality among young males. Shocks to male relative stature reduce marriage and fertility. Consistent with sociological accounts, these shocks raise the share of mothers who are unwed and share of children living in below poverty, single-headed households. These findings are numbing. They point to the vast damage our trade imbalance with China has wrought beyond balance sheets. There seems little doubt that there is a snowball effect in play. The weakening of our job market weakens American society as a whole, which stresses our economy and security. Less employment leads to less spending and less local tax revenue, which lead to a decline in services and infrastructure, creating a drag on social services. These conditions impact federal spending decisions. A shrinking or unproductive economy taxes available resources. Society as a whole suffers. Capitalism with totalitarian characteristics. In a sense, the CCP has taken its cue from the United States' success. Our country's robust economy has continually aided our growth. America's higher education system, our scientific and technological breakthroughs, our banking system, and our investment instruments have helped build us into a world power. We unshackled competitive forces in the economy while ensuring, by rule of law, that the outcome of those forces aligned with democratic principles. This, combined with our nation's natural resources, created a vibrant, dynamic, innovative, and financially successful nation. The Chinese Communist Party has basically patterned its structure on this concept. Money changes everything, with a number of twists to the formula. It dispensed with rule of law, shed any idea of democracy, and focused all outcomes on the strengthening of a totalitarian state. It aligned private profit motive with the national interest. The totalitarian state of China drives all business with the idea of serving the goals of the CCP. That is the basic tenet. The party leadership operates from a very focused, tactical, goal-oriented model. It asks, what do we value? What are our goals? And how do we incentivize our citizens and the rest of the world to do the things that we want? I emphasize that phrase for a reason. Influencing other governments and organizations is the key weapon in unrestricted warfare. The early leadership of the CCP, like that of the USSR, tried to control production on a granular, individual level, such as dictating worker outputs and which factory would make specific products. But Deng Xiaoping realized that what drives individual initiative is the profit motive, making money. Since the CCP controls all monetary policy and access to funds, and also controls the legal structure, it puts itself in a position to control all aspects of the economy. It can and does disburse funds. It can and does underwrite entire businesses. It can pass and has passed a law that says every Chinese company must have a CCP committee operating on the premises. It can also banish regulations, and that is just what it has done. On a certain level, the CCP created one of the most laissez-faire, that's French for basically do whatever you want, environments for manufacturing and business. There are no environmental standards. There is no government agency ensuring that products are safe. There is no better business bureau or bureau of consumer protection. The lack of such restrictions and safeguards can make it seem as if unbridled, no-holds-barred capitalism has been unleashed. Stealing corporate secrets? Piracy? Theft of intellectual property? Copyright violations? None of these are a problem in China. This is unrestricted warfare applied to global commerce and trade. The fact is, competition among Chinese is often dog-eat-dog, but only as long as the CCP wants it that way. So that laissez-faire environment that investors and manufacturers love, it can turn on a dime, because there is regulation in China. Lots of it. Actually, all of it, since the CCP, by actually choosing not to regulate some sectors, determines what is laissez-faire and what is not. The fact is, China is a closed economy. Sure, foreign companies can set up shop in China if they have a Chinese partner and if that partner has a CCP committee in place to monitor the business. As for foreign investments, once money comes in, it has to stay in China. And when it comes to opening a business in China like Starbucks or McDonald's, theoretically at least, all the money it earns must stay in China to either sit in banks or be reinvested. The same rules apply to every company that establishes a business, that is, establishing operations to sell goods or services in China. Why is this foreign investment rule a theory? Because if the right entity applies the right pressure to the CCP, the government will allow some earnings to be sent out of the country. But that is the quiet and reluctant exception, not the rule. Meanwhile, foreign companies that want to enter the Chinese market, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and many others, are banned by the CCP. These sites allow for free expression. They permit posts and videos about religion, oppression in Tibet, the imprisonment of China's Muslim Uyghur population, and the beauty of the U.S. Bill of Rights. All those things are forbidden in China, so those companies are not allowed to operate there unless they censor users. This restriction also points to a complete imbalance of trade. China has launched a number of giant, hugely successful knockoffs of Google, YouTube, and Facebook, Baidu, Youku, and Weibo, to name a few. All these sites are available in the United States and around most of the world where they are monitored by the CCP. But in China, they flourish without American competition. As for the Chinese unit of money, the yuan, it is not traders on the foreign exchange market who dictate how much it is worth, which is how every other currency in the world is valued, but the Chinese government. The concept of ownership in China is also fungible, as we'll explore when we delve into China's obsessive acquisition of technology. Assets from one company can be transferred to another in the blink of an eye. And if you had a stake in the company that lost those assets, guess what? Too bad. The CCP giveth, and the CCP taketh away. The free market myth. China is predatory and destructive when it comes to the economies of other countries. Countries, in fact, from which Chinese firms generate profits. Ironically, when critics note that China is not playing fair, and make suggestions to force Beijing to play by the same rules everyone else abides by, China apologists launch into a familiar, disingenuous refrain. That would destroy the free market system. This would be funny if it weren't so outrageously hypocritical. There is no such thing as a free market as long as the second biggest economy in the world doesn't actually believe in free markets. There's endless evidence that the CCP is dead set against them. There is no free market when a dominant force restricts access, restricts cash flow, and restricts the free flow of ideas. China invests in an estimated 20% of U.S. startups as part of its Made in China 2025 plan, unveiled in 2017, which calls for the country to dominate emerging and traditional industries, including new materials, artificial intelligence, integrated circuits, biopharmaceuticals, 5G communications, aircraft manufacture, robots, electric cars, rail equipment, ships, and agricultural machinery. If the plan succeeds, China will not only stop buying from our companies like Boeing, General Electric, and Intel, it will compete with them in global markets. Despite this, American investor momentum continues to roll along. In 2019, Morgan Stanley Capital International, a leading index of global stock markets, added a slew of Chinese firms to its coverage. 20% of the index consists of Chinese companies listed on the Shanghai and Shenzhen exchanges. That means that institutional investors and others who use the index as a guide are currently pouring money into those Chinese companies, adding as much as $1 trillion to their valuation within a year. Given everything we know about China's restrictive monetary policy and cooked book practices, the fact that so many financial industry leaders are advocating on behalf of a totalitarian juggernaut suggests a number of possibilities. These people aren't paying attention. They are uninformed, which doesn't seem likely since they all have Bloomberg terminals. Or they have been swayed by the profits they've reaped and the insidious propaganda of the CCP, which erroneously portrays the country as a responsible free trade playland. The other inexplicable refrain many captains of commerce recite is that the free market system is self-regulating. This theory holds that free markets are extremely efficient and that market forces ensure that the business community will always do what's best for itself. This, too, is a false construct and borderline ridiculous. First, as we just demonstrated, with China in the game, there are no free markets. Second, determining the best outcome is a dubious proposition. What is best, and for whom? Are quick profits the best result? Or are long-term gains the smarter play? Or is constant liquidity, having convertible cash, what you want? For the past 30 years, the U.S. business community, the investment houses, the Fortune 500 companies, the Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC, pension fund managers, has allied itself in innumerable ways with the CCP, often against its own long-term best interests. Before we zoom in on the specifics of how the CCP has harnessed its ability to consolidate power in finance, investment, and trade markets to become the most predatory, imperialist economic force on the planet, let's make one more big picture point about how business, wealth, and prosperity has worked in the United States. It provides a striking contrast to the CCP's machinations. When Vanderbilt built railroads, when Carnegie built steel mills, when Ford built cars, when Rockefeller dug oil wells, and when IBM built computers, the government didn't back these entities. Banks did. Investors did. The stock market did. As businesses flourished, the economy expanded, technology and housing improved, and the standard of living increased. It was a free market. There was no government plan, although some companies may have received government contracts and tax breaks, and some cynical politicians profited from campaign donations and stock tips. And yes, business may have influenced friendly legislation, but business did not serve at the government's beck and call. In fact, Things were often the other way around, with governments building roads, water systems, and other infrastructure to allow business to thrive. But government didn't seize what its citizens built. It supported, in essence, a free market. China is a total Ponzi scheme. One of the baffling things about China's rise is how the country has achieved the most mind-boggling growth in the history of the world. There is no other single turnaround like it in modern history. How has it been possible to move so many out of poverty so quickly? It is a long and complicated story and one of the subplots of this book, but here is a one-sentence summary from an economic perspective. They did it by issuing and obtaining massive amounts of credit, by generating billions in foreign investment that remains unrecoupable, and by creating a walled, closed economic system that remains unaccountable to outside audits and fleeces foreign investors. China's a paper tiger, says Steve Bannon, discussing the country's economic growth. Then the former Goldman Sachs VP told me, China is a total Ponzi scheme. The only question we have in China, the only important question, is the economic implosion. How bad will it drag down everybody? Bannon has a strong case. Imagine if Ponzi scheme king Bernie Madoff, who bilked investors out of billions of dollars for years, had been able indefinitely to tell his marks, no, you can't take your money out until I say so. And no, you can only see the financial report that I want you to see. Then imagine if Brazen Bernie had been able, also indefinitely, to tell the Department of Justice, the SEC, and the IRS, no, you can't look at my books, you have to trust my accounting. If those conditions existed in the United States, Madoff would likely still be fleecing his marks, creating profits out of thin air by luring new client cash, taking a cut for himself, and then slowly paying off previous clients. Those conditions basically describe the rules that China has used to fuel its explosive growth, running a Ponzi scheme on a global scale. Foreign investment comes in, but it stays in China. Some of it remains in dollars so China can continue to trade internationally, but the profits remain in non-convertible currency and subject to strict capital controls. Chinese companies, many of which are subsidized by the CCP or used as piggy banks by CCP power brokers, do not follow traditional accounting practices. Therefore, analysts have no way of accurately judging the true fiscal health of Chinese companies, which have a further buffer in that the government-owned Bank of China injects cash into whatever company it deems strategically important. And since, as we'll document in the technology section, the CCP can take assets from one company and instantly assign them to a different company, the idea of regulated bookkeeping is nothing more than a fantasy. Given all this, the West's rush to invest in China's market is at best reckless and at worst insane. So why is it happening? Apparently, Wall Street is too high on the profits it reaps on transaction fees for every trade to care, and pension fund managers are too smitten by groupthink investing, the idea that if everyone is doing it, we will too. They are not alone. The wisdom, or in this case, folly, of crowds is a very powerful force. To shape that wisdom, China engages in a form of media warfare, propaganda and influencing campaigns. The CCP's battle to present foreign investment as safe takes place on many fronts. It woos investors and journalists, welcomes trade missions, and sponsors junkets. It buys official-looking advertorial inserts and places them in respected newspapers such as the Washington Post. China Global Television Network has offered jobs to journalists around the world who have been critical of China's practices, such as deforestation in Africa, in an effort to control the narrative. One reporter, according to The Guardian, turned down an offer that would have doubled his salary. All of this is a part of unrestricted warfare, a calculated charm and misinformation offensive designed to build trust and investment. And let's give the CCP and its propaganda wing credit. They are doing a brilliant job. They are pulling off arguably the biggest con in the world. In November 2018, Chinese President Xi addressed the Spanish Senate, furthering the charade. China will make efforts to open even more its doors to the exterior world, and we will make efforts to streamline access to markets in the areas of investment and protect intellectual property. He offered no timeline, no details for increased investment access, including whether that alluded to easing divestment rules, and zero on how China would enforce IP protections. It was nothing more than, trust me. Part of China's Ponzi success is built on corporate complicity and silence in the West. When companies that have invested heavily in China discover they can't get their money out of the country, and there are literally thousands of these firms out there, what can they do? As soon as they put money in, they find themselves between a rock and a very hard place. That money is trapped. This is a constant refrain whispered by corporate leaders in high places. According to well-placed finance experts, companies such as Chevron, Exxon, Sony, and BMW have billions of dollars in earnings in China, but they can't repatriate their money. China refuses to let it leave the country because it needs those dollars. Numerous investment community sources have told me that, as far as they know, China has not allowed the significant repatriation of any Western investor funds since 2015. If they're going to grow their economy, they have to grow their reserves because they have to trade more with the rest of the world based upon that growth. Kyle Bass, the founder of Heyman Capital Management, told me in January 2019. So China could keep this charade going as long as they maintain the positive current account balance, i.e., more money coming in net than was going out. For the past 17 years, China generated substantial positive current account balances. Now, for the first time since 2001, they're going to record a negative current account for 2018. The National Bureau of Statistics of China, NBS, released numbers for 2018 that showed the slowest GDP growth in 28 years to 6.6%. Given the Bureau's lack of transparency into the various sectors of China's economy, many financial analysts suspect that these numbers are based on cooked books. As Bass noted in an editorial a few weeks after the NBS numbers were released, the last 12 months have seen key Chinese economic indicators such as industrial production, car sales, retail sales, and investment all decline to multi-year lows as the previous round of stimulus abated and China's debt burden continued to cause a downward economic spiral. At any rate, a negative or declining balance, the result of slowing trade and investment, suggests that two fundamentally contradictory things will happen in the short term. First, China will try to generate more foreign investment to sustain its growth. Second, China will not release any profits on that foreign investment, despite that being the obvious point of investment, because it needs every American cent it can muster to pay for its growth. If it looks like a Ponzi scheme and acts like a Ponzi scheme, but denies it's a Ponzi scheme, what is it? China. And the people who invest in it? They are either co-conspirators or victims. Of course, con men, co-conspirators, have other terms for victims. They call them marks, or suckers. Another dizzying difference between China's finance market and Western markets, which again underscores the lack of free trade that exists in Beijing and the manipulative Ponzi scheme nature of the beast, involves China's habit of selective regulation. In the United States, if IBM issues a bond on the capital markets, that money goes to IBM, and investors should have a good deal of confidence that money raised will be spent to improve the company. After all, there's a board of directors and a CEO who have fiduciary responsibilities to make sure the company hits its goals. In China, incoming investment goes where the CCP wants it to go. Again, something we'll examine in greater detail when delving into China's technology obsessions. Feeding China's Ponzi scheme with American investment creates triple-edged risks, too. The financial industry is not just funding the growth of the United States' number one totalitarian adversary and risking losing those funds by turning them into non-convertible capital. It is also drying up valuable investment dollars in the U.S. and other markets. If your pension fund has dollars tied up in China that it can't access, those funds can't be reinvested in rebuilding America's crumbling infrastructure, financing its cutting-edge startups, or supporting restarted manufacturing efforts. Wall Street profits may grow temporarily, but America stagnates. As the founder of a hedge fund focused on making event-based global investments, Kyle Bass devotes a good deal of time to studying China's balance sheet. He confirms Bannon's take on the subject of China's instability. In our early January 2019 talk, Bass deconstructed China's numbers and described a closed economic system that is perilously over-leveraged in ways that make the United States seem like a bastion of responsible, tight-fisted fiscal policy. Curiously, China's credit strategy runs counter to all the CCP's typical long-term strategy planning, according to Bass. But perhaps this makes sense when you consider that the country has needed quick cash to aggressively implement elements of its long game. The way that they've achieved relative stability on their home turf is they've expanded their central bank balance sheet and printed more yuan than any one country has ever printed currency in the history of man, said Bass. When Bass compared the fiscal realities that precipitated the 2008 U.S. market collapse to the current state of China's finances, he shuddered. Going into the financial crisis, he said, the U.S. had $17 trillion of GDP and about 1.3 times the GDP in banking assets, and we had about a trillion of banking equity. When you look at China today, it has a banking system that has $50 trillion worth of yuan, $2 trillion of banking equity, and an economy, GDP, of $13 trillion. Bass is basing his numbers on data from the People's Bank of China, the nation's central bank, and other agencies, and he includes such assets as wealth management products, trust beneficiary rights, and trust loans. He estimates China's total credit at $48 trillion, nearly four times its gross domestic product. By comparison, the United States held about $24 trillion in credit in 2019, but its economy was 37% larger than China's. In other words, China had three times the amount of money in circulation than the United States did, while generating $4 trillion less in GDP. Even with double the banking equity of the United States, a result of positive returns from 2001 to 2015, those are terrifying ratios. Economic theory and the laws of supply and demand hold that printing massive amounts of money should automatically lead to significant inflation. But so far, China has avoided devaluation by refusing to participate in the foreign exchange market. Meanwhile, the CCP controls markets. It also controls the media, ensuring that there will be no stories about shortages or inflation or housing bubbles. And it controls social credit scores, a newly installed system of tracking its citizens' behavior using facial recognition and data surveillance to monitor whether individuals are complying with CCP-mandated laws, which exist as a way to control, and reward the population. Together, then, the country's closed economic system and totalitarian repression work to artificially prevent inflation and enforce stability. Unreal estate. One telling example of China's market manipulation is how it has coped with a real estate market that many experts believe should be crumbling. Entire ghost cities have been erected, filled with high-rise apartments without a soul in sight. The construction glut has resulted in more than 64 million empty apartments, according to estimates. Usually, when there's a surplus of real estate, prices tumble. How has China confounded the laws of supply and demand? Just by preventing the houses from being sold, explains Bass, noting that an apartment purchased for 100,000 yuan remains on the balance sheet at that price, even if the only offers are for half that much. The mortgage market is also malleable in the hands of the CCP. One big reason you're not seeing an immediate property collapse is they don't really have property tax, says Bass. In the United States, an investor carrying 10 vacant apartments would have to pay property tax as well as any payments on a loan. But in China, banks allow people who are behind in a loan just to gross up the loan balance and keep it current. In these instances, it becomes a rolling loan, explains Bass. So that if you owe, say, $4,000 on a $100,000 loan, but you don't have the money, the bank will just make your loan balance $104,000, tacking it onto the principal and say, pay us when you can. Bass says this practice has inspired a saying around his firm, a rolling loan gathers no loss. Financing the future. While the CCP can control the pricing of everything domestically, it is desperately short of resources required to sustain growth. It's one of the largest importers of crude oil in the world, bringing in almost 400 million tons a year. It imports food, base metals, raw materials, and petrochemicals. Those dependencies make China's economy extremely vulnerable, according to Bass. As trade slows, as its domestic real estate market implosion looms, as more and more multinational corporations realize they can't repatriate their investments, China's instability grows. Seen from another perspective, however, this vulnerability also makes the Chinese government dangerous. What steps will the CCP take to ensure it has the cash and the access to foreign capital needed to both sustain itself and continue investing on all the fronts of its unrestricted war? What types of influencing tactics, bribes, blackmail, sabotage, political strong-arming, trade wars, will it resort to in its quest for cash and control? Pirates, scams, and blindness. The story of self-made millionaire A.J. Kubani is the American dream on steroids. But the most recent chapter of his story is the archetypal nightmare that has confronted American manufacturers over the past 30 years. China's flagrant disregard for the international rule of law now threatens the business he built out of nothing. Kubani's parents immigrated to the United States from India in 1959. Assimilation was family policy. My family embraced American culture so much we weren't allowed to speak a foreign language at home, he says. AJ was an industrious kid. Growing up in Lincoln Park, New Jersey, he hustled cash by shoveling snow, mowing lawns, and delivering newspapers. He worked his way through state college, making pizzas and bartending. By the time he graduated, he had $20,000 in savings. He spent his savings importing a bunch of AM/FM radios, took out an ad in a tabloid, and never looked back. Long story short, Kubani parlayed his $20,000 into a company, Telebrands, that designs, develops, patents, and licenses unique consumer products that are frequently sold as part of the As Seen on TV brand. The company has generated more than $1 billion in sales annually for a number of years. Kubani has a sixth sense for problem-solving products. Mini stairs to help aging and overweight pets get around the house. Big vision magnifying glasses. Digital TV antennae for people who don't want to pay for cable TV. And fun home items like Star Show, which beams laser light stars onto your house during the holidays. But he also knows how to create a market. Our products became popular very quickly, Kubani says, because of the millions of dollars we spend in advertising. We market them for many years, primarily through television, and then we started selling to retail chains like Walmart, Target, Walgreens, every major retailer in the country. In the 1990s, Kubani noticed that his company had become a target of Chinese counterfeiters. If you went to a flea market, you would find counterfeits of our products. Everything was exactly the same, identical package, identical brand.